The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Hi, good morning. Hi. Hello. So I'm Nikki. I come here pretty often. It's great to see you all. So for reflections this morning, I wanted to say something about, you know, there's in our culture right now, in our news nowadays, there is so much talk of fake news and fake this and fake that. And I wanted to talk this morning about fake science as it pertains to meditation. And I'll say a little bit about my background, which is why you could skip the bio. So I consider myself a dual lineage holder. So I'm a lineage holder in Theravada tradition, empowered to teach and share the Dharma, which is very dear to me. And I'm also a lineage holder in science. I have a doctorate in computer science. My area is artificial intelligence, and I've also studied cognitive neuroscience. And so I feel like I'm a lineage holder in that lineage also, because as you know, in science also it's a training the same way that in the Dharma, you know, you get trained by a teacher and you get authorized. In science also, you get authorized by a teacher. Okay, now you have your doctor. Okay, now you can go and train other scientists. Okay, you're a lineage holder. So both these lineages are really important to me. They're part of this being. So when I hear some fake science out there, especially having to do with Dharma, ooh, ouch, it hurts. So part of today's talk is a kind of a public announcement of, you know, for all of us to be an informed consumer of scientific information, especially when it shows up in the news. So the title of the talk is To Be a Scientist of Your Own Mind. To be a scientist of your own mind. And actually mind-heart, scientist of your own mind-heart. Because in Pali, in the language of the Buddha, the word citta, which we often take as mind, is actually translated as mind-heart, mind-heart. They're the same thing. Consider that for a moment. Before we proceed, mind-heart. I love that, right? Mind-heart. It's not, because in the West we think of the mind, you know, equivalent to our head, neck up. This is my mind. Whereas mind-heart, this is part of your mind. Take a moment to see if you relate it to your mind that way, your mind-heart, how it might shift it for you. Any reflections as to how it shifts it for you? Any words? Yeah.
Integrated.
Thank you. Yeah.
It connects me with my intuition.
Connects you with your intuition. Anything else that comes out? For me, it's a sense of opening up to the totality of my being. My mind is much more than my brain, my head. So nowadays we hear things like, there are trainers and coaches and speakers who have claims such as, you know, with meditation your brain changes or your brain grows and you add gray matter and how presumably the good parts of your brain will become larger and become activated, and the bad parts of your brain become deactivated and turn off. So nothing could be further from the truth. So, I mean, there's so many things out there. There's so many examples out there. There is, for example, this from a major publisher. There is a Mind Hacker's Guide to Shifting into Brain 3.0, which promises that you can use science to rewire your brain. And among its claims is you can overcome PTSD without medication by strengthening neural circuits in brain 3.0, making your emotional immune system stronger. So, just to be clear, these are not signs, they're snake oil. So, okay, now that I've set you on the edge of your seat, I will make my case. I will make my case. So first of all, to be a scientist of your own mind. So the invitation again, I want to make this talk both practical, because we're here practicing, and also informative. So practically, as a practice, being a scientist of your own mind, first and foremost, it requires humility. You need to have a lot of humility as a scientist of your own mind. Humility about your subject, which is your body, your heart, your mind, and how little the society knows about us. You know, in science, in physics, there was Galileo, and then there was Descartes, there was Newtonian physics, the apple falling, it was all simple, straightforward. Then Einstein came, and then quantum physics, and string theory, and Higgs boson. So we think, it was so simplified back then. So that's where we are with the state of how much we know about our mind, about our brains. I'm going to make it very specific because these claims really are about the brain. So Jeff Lichtman, who is a respected neuroscientist at Harvard, puts it this way. He asks, if everything we need to know about the brain is akin to a mile, so everything we ever need to know, everything that needs to be known is a mile, how far have we traveled so far, do you think? A centimeter. Other guesses? 100 yards. 2 inches. 1 inch. Come on. A millimeter. A micro. I've already set you up. I've already set you up for this, because usually when he asks this in his undergraduate class at Harvard, people usually, tend to guess quarter of a mile, 3/4 of a mile. And his sense is, it's on the pessimistic side. It's about 3 inches. We know some, but 3 inches out of a whole mile. So that's how little we know about how this magnificent brain of ours works. This magnificent brain that you have in your head right now sitting in your seat. It's amazing. There are 100 trillion minimum number of neural connections or synapses in each of our brains, which is at least 1,000 times the number of stars in our galaxy. Each of you right now in your brains, you have at least 1,000 times more connections than the number of stars in our galaxy. Just dig that for a moment. Hey, right here, me. Point the pointer to yourself. This is what's happening. Humility about this body that is you. This amazing you-ness. My good friend, neuroscientist Cliff Sarin, puts it the same way. He said, he puts it in a very poetic way. He says, what we know is simply a cloud of consensus floating over a sea of unknowing. I say that again. It's so beautiful. He says, as neuroscientists, what we know is simply a cloud of consensus floating over a sea of unknowing. So with that, I'd like to have us really have a sense of humility about what we don't know. And Einstein, who was my hero growing up, other kids had crushes on bands, boy bands. My hero, my love was Einstein, nerdy kid. So he says, what I see in nature is a magnificent structure that we can comprehend only very imperfectly, and that must fill a thinking person with a feeling of humility. This is a genuinely religious feeling that has nothing to do with mysticism. Just a sense of awe, humility, religiousness that has nothing to do with mysticism. In fact, it turns out that Einstein was used the word God most out of any other physicist in his writings and teachings, but he didn't refer to a creator God, but this sense of awe, humility, just on the unknowing, that when you actually know something about what you don't know, instead of assuming that you completely know what's happening. So the various claims about neuroscience are kind of these days, even though we know so little, they're claiming that pretty much we know how it works, which is not the case, and I'll say more about it in a moment. So the fake neuroscience is actually, by the way, it's always taught, not by neuroscientists, but by either psychologists or people who are misinterpreting what science is, what neuroscientists are claiming. And usually it's presented, the brain is presented as building blocks. And the goal of meditation is to strengthen one part and suppress another. And for example, how many of you have perhaps recently heard or read about the triune brain model, where there is the reptilian brain, mammalian brain, and the newest part, which is neocortex, where the meaning is made? Yeah, all of us. Okay. So it turns out the triune brain model was debunked 20 years ago, and neuroscientists no longer espouse it. It was a 1960s model. And if you do a quick Google search, actually you'll find it in the Wikipedia. It's right there. But it's still taught today. In fact, I heard it a month ago by someone teaching, a psychologist teaching, and about the triune model. Like, oh, ouch. So, so be informed. So, again, what is often taught is mindfulness causes, you know, makes your amygdala be calm. Otherwise, it'll go haywire, and you need to strengthen your prefrontal cortex to calm it down. It's just a very simplified model, whereas the brain is massively interconnected, and for the simplest task, all parts of the brain essentially need to work together. It's not like there is a good part and there is a bad part. And simplified models are not helpful. I mean, the same way that my hand can do a good deed of generosity, and can also slap someone, the same way the area of different parts of the brain are engaged in different acts. There is a wonderful article that I'm going to read a few paragraphs for you. The article showed up in the Mindful magazine in June of this year, and the title of it is "The Magnificent, Mysterious, Wild, Connected, and Interconnected Brain." It's a pretty great article. I recommend reading it. It's an interview with two well-known neuroscientists, one Cliff Saran, whom I know and love, and Amishi Jha, who's another cool, great neuroscientist, and both work in the area of mindfulness and meditative practice. So Amishi Jha here is talking about how these simplified models are actually not even used for teaching our children. So she says, coincidentally, that occurred to me with my daughter. When she was 7 at the time, she jumped on my lap while I was working on my computer. She ended up picking up a model brain I had sitting around. Not surprisingly, she took the whole thing apart. She lifted up one piece after another and asked, "What does this do?" With the occipital lobe, I said something like, "It helps you to see." For the temporal lobe, it helps you to hear. For the cerebellum, it helps you to coordinate what's coming from all your senses and so on. I was just giving her simple answers because I was trying to work. At some point, though, I said, no, let's not do it this way. Let's talk about how this actually happens. Then I talked to her about how all of these parts never work alone. They always work together, but they work in specific ways together. As an analogy, I asked her to think about what body parts she would use to do a cartwheel. She said, I need my hand, and that's connected to my arm, and that's connected to the rest of my body. As I coaxed her through this investigation, she realized she needed all those parts and more, and she needed them to move together in a pattern that results in a cartwheel. That's a pretty good way to think about how the brain works. All of these different parts talk to each other, and they need to act together for us to accomplish something we're trying to do. She seemed to get that. You just can't think of the parts in isolation. You always have to think of how they work together with other parts and with the whole. So I think you can be simple and accessible and also correct without introducing a lot of distortion. So it's distortion that I think is often introduced. So you think, okay, well, so what's the problem with having distortion? You know, if it's a simplified model, if it helps me kind of understand what the brain does, but it's not really correct, it's just a very, very simplified model. So the problem is multivarious problems. One is, you know, as human beings, we often have this desire for simple understanding, the satisfaction that we understand, right? We want the satisfaction instead of being with a sense of not knowing, with the sense of, I don't know. And I have a sense of awe, and it's amazing, and this is kind of how it works, but I completely understand it. So we sell ourselves short for the satisfaction of this simplified model, satisfaction of understanding. Whereas actually what's happening is we are making a devil's bargain. So the devil's bargain works like this. With the devil's bargain, you think, oh, okay, I'm going to do this practice so that this area of my brain will grow and this part will shrink. And I've even seen people and heard people who try to like lean to one side, so one part of their brain, or try to send quote-unquote energy to different parts of their brain so that they get lit up or work harder. And it's basically wasting your precious life, precious time, doing things that are not conducive, that do not work. The proof of the pudding is in the eating. The way that the brain works is through your behavior, through how you feel, how you act. So, for example, if a practitioner is sitting and is sending energy or trying to light up, doing this task to light up this areas of the brain to have better brain, whereas you could be sitting and just practicing loving kindness, compassion. You could be practicing mindfulness. You can be practicing these various well-known practices that are actually practices for your whole mind, heart, body, that really cultivate you as a being instead of trying to light up this area and making your being equivalent to a part, just this tiny little part of your brain. So reducing your entirety, your complexity, your humanity to this part, which is not actually the same. It's not equivalent. It's almost similar to, you know, in healthcare, how sometimes human beings are reduced to just their disease. Oh, there's a gallbladder in room 2, there's a, hemorrhage in room 3. You know, you don't want to be a, whatever, slow prefrontal cortex in row three, you know. That's not how you think of yourself, and you want to think of yourself, this entirety of your humanity. The other aspect of the devil's bargain is that, again, reducing your humanity, your mind, your heart, to the simplified model of a neuralist, reductionist, materialist neuralist. That's another devil's bargain. And let me expand on that. So hold this on your mind right now. So you are so much more than just a reductionist, neuralist part of your brain, the entirety of your being. So let's consider... Let's consider first this idea of mind-heart. So there's this wonderful photo that my friend Cliff Sharon shared with me. It's a photo from 1992 in Dharamsala, and there are a bunch of monks sitting, and this is when the Westerners, I think for the first time, might have been their first visit, one of their first visits, when they went to Dharamsala to visit the Dalai Lama and collaborate and study the brains of long-term practitioners. So there, in this photo, there is a group of monks sitting and laughing. They're really laughing hard. And there's some, and in the front, there are some neuroscientists, and then there's Francisco Varela, well-known scientist, with an EEG cap on. And the monks are laughing. The reason why they're laughing is apparently the translator translated that they're trying to study the mind. And they're laughing because, wait, these scientists are looking at the wrong place for the mind. The mind is here. The mind, and they're pointing to their heart. They're just tickled. These people are looking at the wrong place. It's like Mullah Nasruddin looking under the bright light for his keys because... that's where the light is. You know, he lost his keys at home, but that's where the light is. So so the idea, what is the mind? Mind, heart. What is... So you are not just your brain. So opening that both in terms of practice, but also, let me bring some other things from science. So your microbiome. So nowadays, we've all probably heard about our microbiome, which includes bacteria, fungi, archaea, and viruses. And the human microbiota, and microbiome refers to their genomes. So humans are colonized by all these organisms, microorganisms, and the estimate was that 10 times as many non-human genomes are in our body than human genomes. Did you get that? So in your body, the estimate was that you have 10 times as many genomes of bacteria, fungi, and archaea than your own genomes. That has been, estimate has been lowered to 3-to-1, and some people think it's 1-to-1. But even 1-to-1, each of you sitting, you have more non-human parts in you than you have human parts. And if you didn't have those human parts, you wouldn't actually be able to have metabolic homeostasis. Your endocrine system wouldn't work and your immune system wouldn't work. So who are you? And also the microbiome, there's been research showing that it actually controls your mood. So when you're feeling sad, depressed, is it your brain? Is it your gut? Where is your mind? Is your mind here? Is your mind here? Consider that, right? You are made, this is you. This is, it's not just up here. I'll make it a little more interesting, a little more complicated, if you're ready for it. Open it up even more. Okay. So there are parasites that affect people, and we know that there are various bacteria and parasites that affect our behavior. We know that when we get sick. You know, how many of you, when you get sick and you have the flu virus, you get really grumpy, and how many? I raise my hand. So here's even a better example. This is from the the animal kingdom. So there's this parasite called Toxoplasma gondii, which affects a third of the people around the world. But when mice get it, it affects their brain function, and they lose the rodents. They lose their innate fear of cats. Therefore, they go and play with cats, and they get eaten by cats. Why? Because this parasite, Toxoplasma gondii, it lives much more happily in the gut of cats than in mice. You get it? So if it ends up in the gut of mice, it will change their behavior in order for them to be eaten by a cat, I know people are like, oh my God, so that this parasite ends up where it wants to end up, in the gut of the cat, where it really wants to be. Okay? All right. Interesting, right? Fascinating, because the behavior of the cat is now controlled by this parasite. The same way, you know, I couldn't find as fun an example in the human, with us humans, but the cat one really, I'm sure science will find something in the future, but this is pretty graphic. Here's an example from the human realm. When you have a sugar craving, is it your brain or is it the candida, the yeast in your gut? It's pretty amazing. We all have yeast in our bodies, in our gut, in our skin. Sometimes we can have yeast overgrowth in our gut. I've had it. And oh my goodness, the sugar cravings I've had are pretty wild. Who is me? Who is controlling me? Is my brain up here? Is my mind up here? Is my mind here? Is my mind here? Now I'm going to expand it even further. This is fun, you guys. Are you enjoying this ride with me? Okay. So what we can actually say about our mind, you know, so much has been written and about our mind, but, you know, what we can say about our mind. I'll say more I can say what we can say about our brain and what we can say about our mind. Okay. So actually, let me take a step back. What we can say about our brain, since I started talking about fake neuroscience, what we can actually say about our brain, again, I'll use the words of Amishi because she's put it so well, is that what we can say is that there... The metaphor that is prevalent among neuroscientists today is the network view of the brain, that there is dynamic, interconnected sets of systems and subsystems and neural nodes that work together to carry out a certain kind of activity. So there's systems and subsystems. So it's, you see, the systems are in interconnectivity, so there's massive interconnectivity that work together. Another thing that we can also say about the brain, and I'll get to the mind in a moment, another thing that we can say about the brain is that, you know, there is neuroplasticity. Everything that you do changes your brain. It's not just meditation, right? This experience is changing. You're different now than half hour ago or an hour ago when you came to IMC and sat. And now you're listening to these ideas. So there is neuroplasticity. One thing that also seems to be true is that meditation seems to be categorically different in the way it changes your brain. That the performance benefits seem to generalize. That's the difference. It's in the generalizability, not necessarily where, but so. In contrast, when you think there are many brain training video games that many people do in order to train their brains, so it turns out that they are not so generalizable. You know, when you do puzzles in order for your memory to get better, it turns out that your brain will really improve in doing puzzles. it's not very generalizable to other tasks, okay? But preliminary research shows that meditation, there's something about meditation that is more generalizable to other tasks. So and it's about the attention, you know, the way, and in this area, specifically in the area of attention training, attentional that people who practice mindfulness training, they perform better than it performs better than other programs in terms of attentional networks, generalize better. And again, as a practitioner, I can just step back and say, well, sure, that makes sense, because when you're practicing mindfulness, it's not something particular you're paying attention to. You're paying attention to anything and everything that arises in your sphere of experience, right? And there's a particular way you're paying attention, right? Not judgmentally, openly, in a relaxed way. So all of these can, this way of training can be more generalizable than a more focused way of paying attention. So anyway, I'm going to step back. So this is what we can say, okay, about the brain. Okay, now what can we say about our mind? Okay, so this is when I'm going to expand it further, what I promised. Okay, so what can we say about the mind? Well, one theory that is a relatively young and thriving field in interdisciplinary research is called 4E cognition. 4E cognition has four E's. I'll mention them and I'll describe them. One is embodied. The first E is embodied, embedded, extended, and active. So that's what we can say about it. So what does it mean? So this 4E cognition model, it assumes that cognition is shaped and structured by the dynamic structure of the brain, body, and the physical and social environment. And this is when I'm going to expand it further. So embodied. So the first E, embodied, that your brain operates within and throughout your body. It's embodied. Your brain is embodied. It's not just up here. It's embodied mind. In fact, it's not just the brain, but also, as we discussed, it's your gut. It's the rest of your body, right? So the mind is embodied, embodied mind. And for those of us practitioners who are familiar with mindfulness of the body as one of the most fundamental ways of practicing, kaya gata sati, kaya, body, gata, gone to, sati, mindfulness. Mindfulness gone to the body, kaya gata sati. Embodied mindfulness, mindfulness gone to the body. It's embodied mind. It's really, it's not just a separate operating machine. So embodiment. And in fact, often when I give meditation instructions, and also for my own practice, embodiment is so important. When I'm sitting and writing an email, when I'm sitting here and talking with you, still feeling my body, embodied mind, embodied. How am I feeling? What's arising right now? Embodiment, embodied. So that's the first E of the 4E. Second one, embedded. That the bodily system is embedded, connected to, and part of an environment. So it's embedded. It's not a standalone. It's actually embedded in an environment. So this embedding, this context, you feel so. If you're sitting, if your body is sitting right now at IMC, sitting and listening to talk would be very different from embedded. If you were sitting on a sidewalk in the middle of New York City right now, listening to a talk, right? It's embedded. It has to do with your environment. So your mind will act very differently. Or if you were going for a walk in nature, that mind is a very different mind from sitting in a dark room, you know, in the tight without any windows. the embodied mind embedded in the environment. Does that make sense? Okay. The third one that extended, the third one is extended. The environment extends through time and space, meaning it doesn't have fixed boundaries and it keeps changing. So it's not just the space, but also in terms of time. So it's contextual. Our mind is affected by the context of our life, both historically, this zeitgeist, where we are in time right now, it affects how it affects our minds, and also globally, what is happening not just in the world, in our family, in our society. So it's contextual through time and space. See how it's expanding this idea of the mind? So it's extended through the environment, through time and through space. And lastly, it's inactive. It's not a passive cognitive process that is predetermined, but we actually enact our reality. In some ways, we create our own reality. Okay. Have you noticed when you have a particular mood, you perceive the world differently? Your mind is enacting your reality. Your mind, same. So there's also some other research. I'm not remembering this very well to give you a pointer. It's a talk on YouTube. I don't remember the name of the person who gave it. But there's this sense that if you actually put the various visual filters that the cognitive filters that we have, we're imagining our reality all the time. In fact, there is so much information, let's say at least visually, in so many ways, visually there is so much information right now coming into our visual field that our brain decides to simplify, oversimplify, and it's creating a reality based on the models that we previously have. That's a complicated way of saying it. A simplified way of saying it is, you know, once bitten, twice shy. If you have been bitten by a snake and you see a rope, right? Your perception, you see a rope on the walkway, you jump because you're so scared. You're creating reality of snake even when it's not there. I mean, there's so many examples of that. If you've been hurt by someone, you create a new reality of perceiving them in hurtful ways, even if they might be completely friendly. So I invite you to think of your mind, your being, not reduced to this activity of just one part of your body. I mean, you're selling your magnificence short in that way. But keep in mind that your mind really is embodied, embedded, extended, and inactive. And that can be a much more helpful for you to be a scientist of your own mind. I'll leave you with one last quote from Einstein. Let's see if I can find, where was it? Actually, two quotes. Oh, one from, this is a good one. This one is from Rilke. It's about questions. So, being a scientist of your own mind, be curious and don't seek easy answers. Don't just seek the satisfaction of knowing a simplified answer. So Rilke says, be patient towards all that is unsolved in your heart and try to love the questions themselves, like locked rooms and like books that are written in a very foreign tongue. Do not seek the answers which cannot be given to you because you would not be able to live them. And the point is to live everything. Live the questions now. Perhaps you will then gradually, without noticing it, live a long, some distant day into the answer. So live and love the questions themselves. Live and love the questions themselves. And here is a last quote from Einstein. The most beautiful thing we can experience is the mysterious. It is the source of all true art and science. So I invite you to have curiosity, openness towards the mysterious, which is you. Thank you for coming here and practicing. Let's sit together silently for just a second. Thank you for your kind attention.